often when given this topic, the approach was nonetheless, I took the approach that says maybe I should try and go a step back and try and arrange this presentation in a different way. What I will do in my presentation is that I will touch on broadly six areas. The first one being the historical context. And in the, maybe colleagues don't have to the things that I'm going to talk to, a copy of this presentation is in the document that the text that I've distributed. And you will also see that there is a loose page that gives you an indication of everything else that is in the text. Obviously, there are a number of other documents. The Skills Development Act itself, I was told that you have copies. I didn't include that copy here, but that is the other document that maybe we could refer to. And what I chose to do, Chairperson, was to try and give, you know, an illustration on a number of things, because our work is not only governed by there is the Act. The Act makes provision for us to have regulations. And the regulations also prescribe that there must be certain policies or strategies. And beyond the strategies, we must have administrative systems. And beyond the administrative systems, there are other acts that are like the Public Finance Management Act, which impact on our work and so on. And in the presentation, I'm going to try and give an illustration around how all these things link and how are we working, because not all members of the portfolio committee may be, you know, well clued in terms of how these things connect. And that is why I structured the presentation in that way. So I will touch briefly on the historical context, the period preceding 1998 before the passage of the Act, and then briefly touch on the Skills Development Act and its implementation framework, the Skills Development Levies Act 1999, which is a separate act, the National Skills Development Strategy, and then how it is being implemented, especially by CITAS, the National Skills Fund, and the National Productivity Institute, and then lastly touch on some of the work that is currently underway. Briefly on the historical context, we have had a number of legislations that govern skills development in the country. If you go back to the pieces of legislation, going back to the 1924 Act and subsequently the 1954 Act, which dating back to the Native Training Act, what they used to call the Bantu Builders, legislation and so on, the building, there are a number of legislations, that the Apprentice Act of 1941, etc. We've got a whole history of all these legislations, and beyond that, I think in the late 70s, another new generation of legislation with the granting of independence of the TDV system, the Manpower Development Act of Botswana, the Vendor Manpower Development Act, the Transkei Manpower Act, and so on, and what we call the self-governing territories also had their own legislation, the Kazankulu Training Act and all that. And with the previous government also amended all those legislations and ended up with the Manpower Training Act of 1981. Now, before, 1994, when the Department of Labor finally, with the dawn of democracy, came into existence, there was all this legislation were in place. And what was then passed was the Integration Amendment Act, which sought to integrate all those, integrate and repeal all those legislations that were in force and align them with the Manpower Training Act of 1981. So the Integration Amendment Act amended all those pieces of legislation, and in some cases, like the Botswana Manpower Development, the mandatory manpower development of Botswana, there were transitional provisions that would remain in force until we repealed those revisions. But then we're stuck with the Manpower Training Act until around 1998, and the question was then, how do we begin to then phase out the Manpower Training Act? Because even though we had the Manpower Training Act, the truth is that there were a lot of problems with that act. If you look at how the act was basically structured, is that a lot of our people were not included in the act. There was still a lot of discrimination. It focused on the few. It used to use an approach of manpower focusing. It promoted anarchy within the industry, in the sense that only the employers had a say in the training of people, and to a certain extent, the craft unions, Stahl and them, had a very strong say on who gets training, who doesn't get training, and so on, because the representation on what we used to call the industry training board was determined solely by employers. And the main focus was mainly on artisan and very little on the lower level skills, which is some of the reasons as to why we had to then say, what do we do in this area to work towards the repeal of this act. And I think the process of green papers went on and on until we came up with the Skills Development Act. But just briefly on the objective, I think if you go to the main purpose of the Act, in reversing all the things that I've said, the one thing that the Act does is that in terms of its purpose statement, is to encourage workers to participate in scarce skills, apprenticeship, and other critical skills programs, and to develop the skills of workers to improve their quality of life, prospects for work, labor mobility, quality of goods and services, to promote self-employment. And in terms of the broader unemployed people, the Act is quite clear in terms of its purpose being to assist workers to find work, retrench workers to re-enter the labor market, employers to find skilled employees, to provide and regulate employment services, to improve employment prospects of previously disadvantaged people, and to ensure the quality of education and training. That is in the main purpose of this Act. And it also clearly outlines some of the benefits because to employers. And remember this, all the labor legislation, because of the process of having to go through NEDLAC, everybody tries to make sure that they benefit out of it, and there is an agreement out of that. So every party, the trade unions, have to make sure that the Act addresses some of their needs, and the same with the community, government as well, and the same with employers. Now, from the employer side, what they wanted the Act to do is to make sure that it results in the improvement on their productivity and competitiveness, to increase the level of investment in education and training, and to encourage employers to use workplaces as learning environments, opportunities for employees to acquire new skills, and to use the to basically provide opportunities for new entrants to the labor market and to, you know, basically to address the issue of the employer finding it very difficult to find the skilled workers, because the social compact reached at NEDLAC was that the Act should try and make sure that those who are not trained also contribute in terms of the funding of training, because what was happening is that I think with the change of government, there was a decrease. I think apprentices are a good example. They took a lot of knock simply because companies were not online investing in training, and there were fears and all that. And I think there were issues around levels of investment. Some companies chose to pay higher wages to skilled workers who are skilled from other companies, etc. And I think the spirit within NEDLAC was to say, if we come up with an act which provides a win-win situation for all of us, then we must assume collective responsibility in its implementation, in the way in which the act is run, in the way in which we do things in terms of skill development. So I think throughout the whole act, you will see that thing is carried across. We will do things as a collective. It's not only government. Trade unions have a responsibility, government has a responsibility, employers have also shared responsibility in terms of the implementation of this act. Now, what were some of the things that we had to actually look at when the act was actually, in terms of the provisions of the act and the statements that I've said? I think if you look at what is happening in our country, is that there are issues. I mean, the Department of Labor is not alone, and the Skills Development Act should never be understood to be the sole answer to the country's skills program. Education, the National Department of Education, remains the key department in terms of the provision of learning in the country. This was an agreement to say, over and above what government is doing, can't we come up with an act that will supplement those interventions and specifically addressing the labor market problem, and not to replace the national system that is in existence, which is why there was an agreement to come up with a levy. And this was based on the understanding that, on one hand, if you look at the graduates that are coming out of the schooling system, most of them don't have jobs. They are coming out of the schooling system, and I'm sure if you look at the statistics, about 400,000 are coming out of matric annually into the labor market. And at the same time, there are also serious problems around the number of opportunities that are available in the labor market to accommodate the young people. And if you look at the industry side, industry is complaining about the number of jobs that they have that they cannot fill, because they are not suitably skilled people. So, or there are graduates out there that do not necessarily have the necessary experience and so on. And I think this goes back to the debate around whether the learning that is provided in the schooling system is sufficient or you need something else. I mean, if you look into this room, a lot of you are parliamentarians and all that. You went to the school of learning politics in the organizations, in working with the communities and so on. And that learning cannot be underestimated, because you acquire a lot of learning working with people within context. And this is the whole issue around the learning that you get in the classroom but without necessarily the context. And that's where the problem has been. And that is why when companies advertise, they will say we need a person with qualification, but we also need so many years of experience, and the experience must be based in these other areas and so on. And the other thing is that the qualifications that are coming out of the student system or in the jobs are not the kind of jobs that are offered in the labor market. They are not necessarily linked to qualifications. Let me give you an example. You have pilots, you have got electricians, you have all these other things. In the schooling system, what you get is a certificate, is a diploma, is a degree. It's not an occupation. So which means that you needed an additional kind of learning that will then provide you to do that. So I think everybody then said in the act, we must make sure that when these institutions that are going to be established, teachers and all that, their core responsibility is not to replace the learning that happens in the classroom, but to make sure that we coordinate and ensure that the learning that happens in the workplace is properly structured. I think this is one of the fundamental problems that the act in summary tried to address. The other thing was to also try and sort of deal with this issue around how do you also make sure that the demand side is filled with the kind of skills that we need, but also you begin to work with the schooling system to make sure that the young people that graduate from the schooling system are able, when they complete, to enter the labor market in ready to learn. And I think programs such as apprenticeship, learnership system, and internship try to do that, and I'll go into detail around that. Now, how is the act structured? Because that was just the historical context. You have the Skills Development Act in itself, and the act basically currently was amended twice in 1999 and in 2003. But when you look at the entire act, basically it provides the legislative framework, the objective. It makes provision for the establishment of the National Skills Authority, the CTAS. It outlines the functions of the National Skills Authority of CTAS. It outlines programs such as the learnership skills programs and so on, the employment services and all that. But the Act also makes provision. It has a Schedule 2 that makes reference to transitional provision. And why transitional provision? The problem that we faced and that the legal people had to deal with was that when the Manpower Training Act was repealed, there were still apprentices who were in the system, and the entire apprenticeship system still had to continue. Now, it then had a transitional provision that says the entire Manpower Training Act is repealed. However, Section 32 remains in force. And the reason why those sections remain in force is that you still have the apprenticeship system that is running, and you have to govern it in terms of the provisions of the Manpower Training Act, without suggesting that there are no problems in those provisions. And I will talk to those problems and what is it that we are doing about the problems. But there was also a problem when it comes to the implementation of the Skills Development Act, in that it gave the framework around how the Act was going to be structured. And when it came to how are we going to sustain, for example, everything that we are going to do in terms of the Skills Development Act, a problem emerged. Simply because at the time the issue was to introduce a tax, and when you try to introduce a tax, in terms of the constitution, then we hit a problem in the sense that only the Minister of Finance can introduce what is called a money bill. So in that way, the Skills Development Act was then split into two. The Skills Development Act 1998, and then the other component, which is the Skills Development Levy Act, which is 1999. This act basically makes provision around how the skills development is going to be funded, how the contributions are going to be made towards the Skills Development Act, who's going to do collections. And in the Act, it makes provision. There are two provision section, and I have a copy of the Act here. There are two provisions, Section 7 and Section 8. Section 7 says staff can collect, and if staff collect, it goes on to stipulate all other conditions that must apply. And it also makes provision for the teachers to do the collection on their own. And it puts all sorts of conditions, and I think currently there is no teacher that is collecting the skills levy in terms of Section 8. All of them are using SAP, and that is why no teacher is having its own collection, for instance, agencies and all that, or debt collectors and so on. SAP is doing all that. But I think the other pieces of legislation that are quite important that we have to deal with is the South African Education Authority Act. Because this act talks to the whole question of quality. And you cannot deal with quality of learning within the skills development without reference to the SAQA Act, which is why all along we have had this problem dating back to 2001 with higher education and Umalusi and them, because the issue was whether the higher education or the Umalusi, which is under established in terms of the General and Further Education Act, have the jurisdiction to ensure the quality of learning that is necessary outside the work is happening, and there's been problems around that. So it is important to also know about this act, because it does impact on the work that teachers do. And lastly, there's the Public Finance Management Act and the other legislation that you dealt with yesterday, the Labor Relations Act, the basic conditions of employment and the basic conditions of employment, the employment equity and so on. And the reasons why this act are also quite important is because when you look at the conditions of employment of learners, those acts come in. And one of the problems that we have with the Manpower Training Act is that it created its own labor relations dispensation. Where else, if you look at the conditions of employment of apprentices, of learners in learnership, they are governed in terms of the LRA and the BCG. And this is a problem that I'm going to talk to around what is it that we're doing. So that is broadly in terms of the legislation. But the legislation makes a requirement that in terms of the functions of the NSA, is that one of the things that the NSA must do is to produce a national skills development strategy. And this strategy is supposed to be a framework which says where are our priorities, what are the kind of indicators, what are the kind of targets that we are going to meet and so on, and how are we going to use the money that we are going to collect, so that everybody is focused and we can measure the implementation of the Skills Development Act against that. And that is why, in terms of that provision of the Act, we have chosen to produce a National Skills Development Strategy, which is at least 5 years and so on. We had a national skills development strategy 2001 to 2005, and currently we are having the national skills development strategy 2005 to 2010. Some of you were at the conference where this was unveiled. And beyond that, there will have to be a strategy 2010 to 2015 so that it can direct all our energies and that we can be able to measure the input of all sectors. Now, beyond the national strategy, the Act also, in some cases, it will say the DG will conclude service level agreement in a prescribed manner. The money in the CETA account must be used in a prescribed manner, and so on. Now, because of that, what it meant is that we would then have to have a number of regulations that clearly governs those procedures. And I think this is one area where yourself as parliamentarians did not want to go into the detailed operational aspects around how those aspects are governed, and that the delegation was made to a body such as the National Skills Authority, which is an advisory body to the minister, to then assist in the formulation of all those regulations. And those regulations are taken to the state law advisor to make sure that they are consistent with the Act and they are subservient with the Act, and that they basically enable the implementation of those aspects. And in the PEC, I have also included all the number of regulations that governs a whole range of processes. There is a regulation that governs the service level agreement between the department and FITAS. It binds them around, that is, in exchange of money. We collect in the region currently about 5.4 billion rand per annum on the one, based on the 1% skills levy. And the issue is, how do you then hold them accountable? And the Act makes provision that you must have a service level agreement, which is why you then call them to come to Parliament and say, how have you progressed against the service level agreement with the department, and so on. So there are regulations that govern that. In terms of learnerships and apprenticeships, there are also regulations that clearly indicate how a learner is identified, what are their rights, the rights of the provider, the employer, what are the minimum conditions of employment, and so on. And I've also included in this PEC a regulation that governs the learnerships. The National Skills Fund is also provided for in the regulation, I mean in the legislation, and it clearly says the NSF should operate in a specific way, and I will also touch on the NSF. Briefly on the functions of the NSA, is those in terms of advising the minister on the national skills development policy and strategy, which is why we have this strategy, the implementation, which is why we have all these reports, allocations of subsidies from the National Skills Fund, liaison with CETAS, report to the minister on the implementation of the strategy, conduct investigation around a whole range of things, and out of those investigations, they then make recommendations that are mainly then finalized in terms of regulations. If you look at CETAS, now we always have, and this is one problematic area that we have at the moment. In terms of the Act, CETAS have specific functions, but there is a problem between the people's expectations from CETAS and what CETAS are established for in terms of the Act. In terms of the Act, the functions of the CETAS are to develop and implement their sector skills plan, which is around you know, what are the skills needed, and out of that, they produce a sector skills plan. We then do a consolidation of that sector skills plan into a national scarce and critical skills list, which basically says, these are the skills that we need in the country. And then out of that, CETAs don't have a responsibility to train. What they have is the responsibility to pay grants according to sectoral and national priorities. Basically, they are a channel that we use to channel back the grant, the levy system, and to pay grants to employers who are implementing the act. They've got a responsibility to design, to register and manage and promote learnership, to ensure the quality of learning within their sector in accordance with the SAQA Act, to liaise with the National Skills Authority, and to liaise with the employment services, basically to assist in where are the new jobs and to make sure that they refer people and to work with all other educational councils and to report to the Director General in terms of their service level agreements and to yourself in terms of their annual reports and all that. Those are the functions that are in the Act. Now, briefly, if I'm to summarize the Levies Act also. The Levies Act basically says that every employer in the country has to pay a levy of 1% of their payroll to the South African Revenue Services. And this act was again amended because previously it used to only exclude employers that have a payroll that is below 250,000. Now that threshold has been increased from 250 to 500,000, which means all the SMMEs that have payroll that is less than 500,000 are exempted from paying the levy. That is the first point. The other thing is that government departments and all other entities that get more than 80% of their allocation from the vote allocation are exempted from paying the levy. So technically what it means is that the skills levy is paid by the private sector, the entire 1% of the payroll. The Act says that government departments may contribute. They may contribute towards the administration of the CETA. And that contribution currently is happening. It is inconsistent, and it does happen as and when some departments have savings and so on. And I think this has been a major problem in the implementation of the Act, because the contribution is not consistent. So you have that problem partly. But the Act basically, on the 7th of each month, SARS collects what they call a development levy. Now, if you go to this pack, we've also included a publication, one of the gazette. If you look into your pack, there is a gazette number 27445. That government gazette number 27445 clearly indicates to you the classification of all industries. We've given them a coding system. Now, if you look at the safety and security, you'll find that all industries that fall within the legal activities and all that were given a specific code. And the other thing is that you will see that the numbers of these CETAs, you'll have CETA number one. If you can go to that that you'll find that there are a number of sitters there. It's just that this one gives you, do you have the one that says schedule one, and it has sitter names. That one page is first page. Now, you'll have sitter number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you have sitter number 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, and then they go on to 27. The reason why you still have those numbers is simply because we had to spend a lot of money under the National Skills Fund with the South African Revenue Services to invest in a levy collection system. And if you look at the rest of the Gazette, you will see a lot of numbers called the SIC code. These are the codes that were given to all industries in the country, the Standard Industrial Classification Code, which means that we are able to know throughout the whole country all the companies that fall within a specific code. And when their money gets collected, it goes exactly into the right seat. And that is why we are able to make sure that we are able to transfer that money, correctly to the relevant seat. And one seat will not have their money transferred to a different industry. So we use that, this whole process to have all other industries obviously exempting those that are below 500,000. In total, we are talking about 370 something thousand odd companies that were originally on the list, and with their exemption, we had to remove all those companies, and we remained with companies in the region around 179,000. That is the companies that are currently paying the levy. So around the 7th of each month, SARS does the collection. We normally do the verification of the information, and SARS issues a certificate which comes to the department, and we sign it off, and it then releases money from the national revenue account, and we then effect the transfer. 80% of that money collected goes to the individual sitter, and they go, that money unfortunately does not go proportional. It goes in accordance with the contribution, because you have to look at this. And 20% of that money goes to the National Skills Fund. Under the National Skills Fund, we then have to pay up to 2% of the total levies to SARS for the collection, leaving the NSF with about 18%, and we also then have to take a further 2% because the Act makes provision for that, for the administration of the NSF, and the NSF remains with about 16%. In brief, this is how the Levies Act basically works. The money in the SITA account, the 80% goes towards, the 80% goes back to SITA, and 20% remains within the NSF, less the 4% that I talked about to fund the national skills funding windows, and the rest goes to SITA. Now, if you look at the money that we're going to collect, we looked at the total income in 2005 and made projections to 2010 to say by March 2010 what is the total amount of money that would have come into the system without necessarily taking into consideration things like the fluctuation, that is, with the economy growing. Obviously, now we are collecting more than what we originally collected, because this was what we call a linear projection. So using the 2005 projections, by 2010, we would have collected in total 21.9 billion, of which 16.8 billion would go to CTAS and 5.1 billion would have gone to the NSF. And currently with the economic growth and a number of companies now going beyond 500,000, that figure is increasing. And I think the figures annually are beginning to move from 4.8 billion this year, for instance, until end of March, it was about 5.4 billion. So which means the levy collection is also increasing. And I think the compliance rate with the elimination of all the small companies is now standing at around 98-99%. So which means the 2% that is not paying is not because they're not paying, it's companies that are going under liquidation, changing hands, merging, and so on. So you always have that margin of error, because all the big companies are in the system and you don't have problems around collection. Now, how is this money split? The 80% that goes to the FITA in terms of the Act is that 50% of that money goes back to employers as mandatory grants. That is, this is money guaranteed to go back to employers on condition the trade. And the FITAs have only 20% to use as discretionary funds to promote the things that are to the benefit of the industry. And they only have 10% out of the money they get to fund their administration. The only exception is if the employer has not claimed, then they've got a portion of that 50%, because in terms of the regulation, what we have realized is that sometimes CTAS will keep this money waiting for the employer to come and claim, because in actual fact that money belongs to an employer. And when we amended the Act, we also wanted powers to be able to shift that money, because in some instances, the company will submit a plan. Now, if an employer submits a plan to say, this is the areas I'm going to train, and these are the kind of people I need, the FITA is stuck with that money, because when the employer says, I've trained, these are the results, the FITA has to pay. And if the FITA pays upfront before the training happens, the Auditor General comes and says, on what basis have you paid? Because these people have not even as yet implemented their program. And in some cases, it becomes very difficult, because then the FITA has to chase an employer who has not trained. And once they've paid the grant, there is no longer reason to fill forms, because the money is already paid. So that the FITA has to keep the money. Now, unfortunately, one of the unintended consequences of that arrangement is that the FITA ends up having all this money in the account, waiting for claims to be made. And the unfortunate things like the fidentia and all that happen precisely because of that. Because while that money is held in the account, the Act makes provision for that money to be invested, either in the four-star rated banks, and all other institutions that meet the Financial Services Board stipulations and all that. And unfortunately, while that money is held in those kind of accounts, you have money that is sitting waiting to be claimed and so on. But that is the nature of the Act, because if you are sitting with a, if it is like a chicken and egg situation, you pay, people don't train, you hold money, and that is that has been the kind of driver, because that is the leverage that FITAS has. And what the amendments did and helped us with is that if up to a certain period they have not claimed, then we will transfer that money as part of discretionary funds. the NSDS in brief is just it basically titled this document. I won't go through it. It just clearly says in the next 5 years, what are we going to support? And in this case, the vision is around growth, development, and equity. It has a mission statement, and it has principles. And it then clearly says, if the CTAs are going to contribute X, what are the kind of incentives that we are going to contribute from the NSF, and what are the principles that are going to drive? And I think in terms of the principles, I will talk to that. And it has 5 objectives, 20 success indicators, and it then clearly outlines what are the interventions that we are going to make in the first economy, the second economy, and how are we going to then use both, that is the money that we have collected, because that is what the strategy is meant for. And briefly, in terms of the vision, you can see Skills for Sustainable Growth, its mission is that the National Skills Development Strategy contributes to sustainable development of skills development and equity. In terms of the indicator, which is what is it that is going to be used to measure whether we're failing or succeeding, is that government and its social partners assess the contribution of the NSDS institutions and resources to the nationally agreed strategies for growth, development, and equity. Now, unfortunately, again, people then measure from their own perspectives without saying these bodies, the CTAs, NSA, the Department of Labor, and all the parties have committed themselves to this strategy. If you are to measure the success or failure, measure them according to the strategy that has been agreed to instead of other things. And the principles, I think, are quite important, because the first one is that it is mainly to support economic and growth for employment creation and poverty eradication. The second one is to promote productive citizenship, and the third one is to accelerate broad-based black economy empowerment and employment equity, and it has specific targets, 85% black, 54% women, and 4% people with disability, including all that is youth in all categories. And it specifically makes provision for learners with disabilities to be provided with assistive devices and to support and monitor quality, and lastly, to advance the culture of excellence. Those are the principles that are again connected with the Act. And in brief, you have all those 5 objectives that I'm not going to go back to. The first one was to say that we must prioritize, communicate, get the critical skills list, and all those processes around get the critical skills list came out of this, because one of the fundamental aspects is to say where the skills shortage, to make sure that when people train, they train in those areas. Secondly, is to promote and accelerate quality of training in the workplace and employability and sustainability for people who are unemployed. That is where the NSF comes in, and assisting young people, especially new entrants in the labor market, and quality of provision. Now, what is the connection of the NSDS with everything else? The NSDS, like I said, is just one component which is looking at the workplace. When we talk about the skill shortage in the country, you need to understand that within a bigger context of human resources development strategy. Now, the minute you begin to talk about human resources development strategy, we are bringing in a lot of other parties. The education department, which is the biggest recipient of the government vote, is the lead department, because they get the biggest slice in terms of the supply side. You have to bring in the science and technology department, because they have the budget for all the research, the CHS, the HSRC, the CSIR, the FRD, which are all these research and development institutions, the South African Bureau of Standards, SNGS, and so on. Because those are the bodies that receive national votes to say where are we going in terms of technology, new skills, and all that. You have to bring in the Department of Public Service and Administration, because that is the biggest employer in the country in terms of the public service. And if you have to bring in the three spheres of government, local, provincial, and national government, and there are other departments like health and so on. So when you talk about HRD, the Department of Labor, in fact, is the smallest player in the process. Now, unfortunately, when the debate around the shortage of skills comes up, we find ourselves on the receiving end, because it does seem as if we are not doing enough given the resources that we have. And yet, if you measure the resources, where they come from, what the original intentions were, those resources are very, very little, and they were meant to address a specific objective. And yet, there are then problems around CETAs being seen, as if they are not institutions that are delivering in terms of addressing the skills development needs of the country. And I think this is one of the problems, because on the demand side of the skills, it is employers, it is government, it is everybody else. But people forget that the demand for skills is a bigger HRD issue. It's not only a small thing that is confined to the National Skills Development Strategy, because that is one of the components and not the ultimate solution, because it was never to be the ultimate solution. And we've had debates as to whether the usage of the 10 National Skills Development Strategy was the correct one or not, because we were convinced that this was the correct notion, because you still have a National Human Resources Development Strategy, a Human Resources Development Strategy in the public service, a National Science and Development Strategy, and all that. And I think if people in our country can begin to understand that the bigger thing is the National Human Resources Development Strategy, which the Department of Education was asked to lead in terms of cabinet decision. And I think whether they've led it or not is something else. But I think initiatives such as GIPSA, the Joint Initiative on Priority Skills, came about because there was no national leadership that was trying to address at a national and at an integrated level the shortage of skills in that area. That is why GIPSA came in, and the Deputy President took leadership in that area, and that is why she's now convened all the ministers, Minister of Education, Public Service, Home Affairs, everybody who has got responsibilities in terms of HRD. She convenes meetings, she brings labor, business, and all that, so that we can march in a particular direction, so that we're able to support our GIFA. And that was after the realization that skills development and in terms of CETAs alone, you cannot address the National Skills Development Strategy. And I think this was just to try and outline the problem. Let me then go to, I think I mentioned the fact that the NSDF, then its responsibility is to govern how CETAs in the main, the NSF, is going to implement the National Skills Development Strategy, and currently we are also using it to redirect Umsobomvu's fund and the National Productivity Institute, because the two bodies will also, I mean, they are working with youth and all that, and we then had to say, how do we realign all these things? And in terms of the CETA, we basically, in terms of the service level agreement regulations, have, service level agreement, and this is basically just an illustration around how this actually works. We negotiate with CETA based on the income. I mean, the clothing and textile, if you look at, again, this document and the number of companies, you will notice that the companies are small. But that also means that the income they get is also small. The NESITA will be big, and the income they get will also be big. We committed ourselves to, for instance, 125,000 learners in learnerships in 2010, and there are also annual figures, which means that if we are to meet 125, we must produce about 25,000 per annum. Now the question then was, how do you then distribute the numbers so that we are able to achieve them by year? So we looked at the income and said, you receive a lot of money, you are the biggest employer, and therefore from you we will demand so much, and will demand a less number from a specific sector because it has less income and all that. And that is how we then conclude service level agreement, and we then assess them against them. Because you cannot conclude a service level agreement that is standard and do across the board assessment without taking the income into consideration. So when they come to present to you on their targets and all that, and the reason they differ, it's because of the income that also differ and the service level that we assign. Currently the DG is the key person. He has delegated me as the head of the skills development to then conclude this service level agreement, because from where I'm sitting, I'm able to see that this one is not performing, and then you then implement the other provisions of the act where a CETA is not performing and so on, and we take some things up with the auditor general and so on. This gives you just a sense in terms of the mandatory grants. We have had complaints previously that small companies that have a payroll that is above 500,000 but employs less than 50 people, the paperwork is just too much. So those companies are exempted in terms of the act. They don't have to do the paperwork. They simply just submit proof that they've trained and they can get their income. Obviously, the AG was not happy with that, because on one hand, you are trying to lessen the bureaucracy of having to process claims. But the AG is saying, before you pay, you must go and make sure that training has actually taken place. And obviously, I mean, if you look at 179,000 companies, I mean, those are big industries. When you talk about one company, it may be IFCO. And IFCO may have a number of sites. IFCO in Pretoria, IFCO in Vanderbilt, has Newcastle, and they may have other subdivisions. When you talk about Woolworths, it's one company, but they may be having all these companies, I mean, and shops throughout the country. Now, it becomes very, very difficult to verify each and every site. And I think what they normally do is to just do a sporadic kind of a verification to just say, look, here we believe that there's a problem and all that, and they just do sampling, and then they go and check in those areas. And if from the sample of 10 companies belonging to a group there is compliance, then there's no reason to doubt the payment in other areas. Otherwise, if you are to do verification you spend a year or two whilst you are still doing the certification, and then you don't pay, and then people then start complaining to say this labor framework is not happening. So we exempted those, and we pay without saying that we don't do sporadic check. In terms of companies that employ above 50, then there is that sampling and the verification process, and the AGM accepted the method that we are using. And there are days on which companies are supposed to submit their claims, and the 30th of September, and nowadays, from 2007, the 30th of June is the cutoff point. And if they don't submit claims, all other monies are swept to discretionary funds, like I said. The 20%, basically what we did in terms of regulations was to outline the 16 areas that the SITAs can use the 20% in. They can use money outside of the 16 areas that have been outlined. And these two slides just outline all the other areas where SITAs can use the 20% plus all other unclaimed funds, interest that is earned in their accounts, penalties, all other administration funds that are not used by the end of the year, they also form part of the administration, the 20%. So those 16 areas basically are the areas that they can use the money in. In terms of the NSF, it receives 20%. The minister, on the advice of the NSA, outlines the funding windows, and the DG is the accounting officer. But in the main, the NSF funds all those national projects that are identified as national priorities. They can be in cities, they can be in provinces, and they can be in government departments and so on. And it can fund all other related projects that are identified by the Minister of the DG. And I think this, if you recall, has been one of the things that had to go to the National Assembly for a vote. And the reason why we continue to experience a problem on the NSF is that there are some people in industry who still believe that the NSF is their money, and they argue that the government is not contributing, but at the same time it is the 20% what we call scheme of that is being taken out of the contribution to deal with issues of redress. And that this money should be used to top up SITAs if they run short. Whereas the Act is quite clear. It says this money is to be used for redress purposes and all that, and that if it is not sufficient, government can also contribute towards that. And I think there have been tensions. And currently, as members of Parliament, you were aware, those of you who have been in the Labour Portfolio Committee, and maybe other new members may not be aware of the problem, is that there have been problems because of that, to an extent that the AG has now said the NSF must be administered as a public entity. It must have its own board. It must be outside of the departments and all that. And I think there are tensions because in terms of the main aim of the Act, it was meant to be a specific, to deal with specific areas that you can intervene and address those as government. But in terms of its administration, if you go the route that the AG is suggesting, it's like privatizing it, and the minute it's privatized, you then are forced to use different rules. And in using those different rules, it becomes very difficult because it then means that the private rules will then have to apply. To give you a simple example, currently for the training providers that are looking at the unemployed, in Namakhale or whatever, there's a simple process where they have to simply with the municipality apply at the labor center, the project is assessed there and the money is allocated there, and training happens. With the public entity route, because of the accounting, tendering process and so on, it then simply means that this thing will have to be administered somewhere at the national level. There must be a tender that must go to the tender board, and some other people must do the adjudication on in terms of the tendering procedures of the NSF. And you know the difficulties that our people still face in terms of understanding all these procedures and so on. And I think that is why all these years there's been a problem with the department saying that, look, you may be coming with the accounting principles, but those accounting principles are in conflict with the original purpose of this provision as outlined in the Act. And currently, because of the accounting principles and the qualifications we got, we are then forced to go the listing route. But again, with that listing process, there are still problems, because what it then means is that either you can look at the Act and remove the accounting principles, and we'll have to come back to you and say, members of Parliament, there is a conflict between the original intentions and the accounting. Either you change the accounting principles so that the original purpose can continue to happen with the relevant accounting that suits the original purpose, or you change the original purpose of this thing, because in terms of the accounting principles, there is a conflict, and therefore you have to determine a completely new role for this fund. That is the current problem that we are sitting with as we begin to unpack what the AG is saying. And I'm sure when Scopa said the Labour Portfolio Committee must address this issue, it is that problem in terms of the Act. Now, the NSF has got cross-cutting areas that says we must use it to address equity target, BBBE, we must address issues of geographical spread, the urban-rural split, the question of the corporate governance, because one is not saying there must not be accounting, but it's saying that the accounting must fit the needs on the ground and all that. And over the years, and if you can go back to the Manpower Development, the Manpower Act, it had a Manpower Development Fund. All the Manpower Acts that I'm talking about, for instance, the Manpower Development Act of Ukhtaswan, it had a Manpower Development Fund. And the system that we've been using is more or less the same, because it has been a developmental kind of an arrangement. And all these years, the model that the previous government used, the TPVC states and all that they've used, is more or less the same model that we are using in the administration of the NSF. But now we have been told that no, you have to change and go a separate route, which is where the problem is coming in, because it then flies against the principles. There are 9 funding, windows that have been identified. The social development initiatives, which is mainly in support of public EPWP, and all the EPWP interventions that are happening across the country are funded from the Department of Labor under this fund. The second one is the adult basic education and training. Although this is a component that is squarely under education, but because of the realization that in employment you have got a lot of people who are illiterate, who are finding it very difficult to go to higher levels, we then had to come in, because a lot of adult people cannot make use of the opportunities that are available because of lack of basic education. The other one is the question of critical skill support program, and then there are issues of industry support, constituency capacity building, special project and so on. Chapter, then you tell me where to stop, or maybe I should finish the presentation and take questions after.
Yeah, I think so. After the presentation, we'll have to break for tea.
Okay. So those are the funding windows, and the money, about 1.2 billion that comes in for under the NSF is spread across all those funding windows. The numbers that you have on the other side should not be complex to you. These are the numbers that are in the strategy. If you take indicator 3.1 and you go to the strategy 3.1, you will then be able to see the connection between the two. I didn't want to rewrite them again because the slide was going to be very busy. What is the relevance between the strategy and AGISA and sector growth and development strategy? Is there connection? We believe that there is connection because all the AGISA projects, without saying that the NSDS is the alpha and omega, it is a component that is contributing with all other NHRC players. We believe that where industry is able to say these are the skills that we need and they are able to put those in their workplace skills plan and the sector skills plan. CITAS were able, because the process starts with the workplace skills plan. Every company, in order to get a grant, has to produce a workplace skills plan. And this must be produced between companies, that is, employers and employees, in a workplace forum. That gets channeled to a CETA, and the CETA takes hundreds of these things to produce a sector skills plan. And this sector skills plan comes to us, we then produce a scarce and critical skills list that supports the growth and development strategy. And the training that happens then is in line with the sector strategy and in line with the workplace skills plan. And companies get their grants on the implementation of the workplace skills plan. That is how the system works. In conclusion, just to alert to members of parliament, there are a number of things that have been identified in the strategy. We have taken note of the kind of things that are happening in the media, that are happening in GIPSA, question marks that are being raised everywhere, and so on, around how best are we supporting or not supporting the second economy and all that. And that is why in organizing this year's National Skills Conference, it is going to be different from the other years where we would have 4,500 people or so on. We are going to confine it to about 400 people maximum. And the reason why we are doing that is because we want it to be engaging on some of those key issues. We have produced four papers that are being discussed now, and the constituencies of the National Skills Authority, labor, business, and so on, will discuss some of those issues so that they are able to say, under the first economy, second economy intervention, these are the key issues, this is where we have been failing, going forward, this is what we are going to do. On the scarce and critical skills, the National Skills Development Funding Framework, because there are some people who are saying, maybe it's time that we have to review the levy, the 1% may not be enough, or maybe it's time that we do away with the employer's grants because employers are in any way spending 5% or 4% in some cases, use the 1% for the needs of the entire sector and so on. Because at the time when the levy was introduced in 1998, the situation has changed. The demands are different. Some are saying maybe the 1% was a start, maybe it's time to review that. Now we are leaving all those things for the conference, and we are hoping that the outcome of the conference would then inform, you know, some of the things that we say going forward beyond 2010, what are the kind of changes that we need to look at. Because part of the difficulty in terms of this process is that we need to start thinking 2010, 2015, and what are the kind of changes in terms of the legislation that may be warranted. But parallel to that, there are like other things that we believe are technical, that we believe cannot wait for that process, that we are going to be coming back to you, that we have raised previously in terms of the Act, and I will touch on this. And beyond that, I think there's been debate around the number of sitters. This thing has been in the various policy documents. You know, there's been debates around sitters. But I think it arose out of the confusion on their role and all that. And we're dealing with this matter because, and I think the minister clarified that issue. And if you look at the regulation, you give sitters a license of 5 years. And in the last year of their existence, you do a proper review in order to determine a landscape going beyond that. And the next review in terms of regulation is going to be in 2009. However, given the demand for skills and the blends that I've talked about, people were calling for the review of sitters now. And that, I think, has also led to some confusion. And I think one of the unfortunate things that we debated was that if you handle this thing in an insensitive way, the disappearance of funds and all those other things, the downturn in terms of trade starts happening, because when you create uncertainty in an environment, all sorts of things happen. I mean, you saw with the merger of colleges, FETs, the universities and all that, people start looking for vacancies, I mean, for jobs somewhere, nobody cares, assets start going in all different directions and so on. And I think we went to the presidency, to other people, and said, look, we are the department that is administering the Act, and you are saying all these things without talking to the department. And in the process, you are creating all this confusion, and this is going to be the unintended consequences of your action. And that is the reason why the minister then said, I hear the complaints about the number of sitters, the issue of shortage of skills development, etc. But at the end of the day, we've got laws, regulations, and so on. And people should not operate as if we're in a banana republic. If Parliament passes laws tomorrow that changes the situation, we'll implement. People should call for this thing to be reviewed, but in accordance with the legislation and so on, which is why he then clarified the statement around the timetables and so on. The other thing that I said cannot wait, I think, are the amendments that we believe we will be able to submit by November. We are aware of the short time that Parliament may have next year, given the elections and so on. But we believe that there are some technical amendments that have to be effected in the legislation. If I can go back to the Manpower Training Act, I think this is one of the legacy legislation which is not gender sensitive and so on. But at the same time, there are problems in the Manpower Training Act in the sense that the conditions of employment of apprentices are firstly in conflict with the Constitution, and they are in conflict with the Labor Relations Act and the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. Now, we then have to bring them in line with those two acts. The learnerships are okay. Now, currently there is a demand for artisans, And I think everybody is quite aware of that. But then when you accelerate the demand for artisans and the conditions of employment are in conflict with the Constitution, there are a number of provisions in that Act that are very problematic. We are then going to cause or end up with all sorts of problems, and we'll end up with all sorts of legal challenges which is why we then thought of taking the sections that are relevant, and if you go to that schedule, the transitional provision, it creates a problem because it creates uncertainty. So the advice that we got from the state law advisors is to say that remove the sections that are important out of the Mentor Training Act and make them a chapter in the Skills Development Act. And when you do that, remove all other things that are in conflict with the Constitution and align all conditions with the basic conditions of Employment Act and the Labor Relations Act, or maybe have one regulation that will govern both learnerships and apprenticeships so that we are able to deal with that problem. So that is the one section that we are dealing with. But the other problem is that with the decentralization of trade testing and the responsibility of artisans under the Mentor Training Act and the abolition of industry training boards and the establishment of CETAs, a new problem has emerged. ITBs used to have a training component. CETAs don't have. And what CETAs have done is that they have further outsourced that function of assessment of artisans to third parties and so on. And our fear is that if you don't have quality assurance, we will have a situation where Sasol and so on, accidents will start happening in all areas, bridges collapsing and so on, because the quality assurance of artisans in those centers, there is nobody who is moderating that the standards are proper and all that, which is the reason why you then have to make sure that we come up with provisions that will empower institutions such as Indela to go in there and check that the standards are adhered to. I mean, this, if I'm to give an illustration, you have got assessment centers where the assessment of cars before they are given licenses are being done across. And some of the private centers, you know about the corruption that is happening there. When people have their own license to do that, their interest is not about the safety on our roads. Their interest is in passing so many cars because they are running a business and making a profit because of the number of cars they are able to put through the system and to make their center to be popular, because if you go to their center, you know that it doesn't matter whatever condition your car is, it is going to pass. And unfortunately, that is the situation we are beginning to experience, because some of these accredited centers, a person goes to India, like a national center, the standards are quite clear, they fail, we charge in terms of the treasury regulations only 200% for the assessment at India. The private centers charge between 1,500 and 3,500 rand for the same trade test. But there is a problem in that people would normally pass once off in the private trade center. And when these people go to the company, there are questions around the levels of competence. Now, those companies don't care. They are interested in the 3,500 and all. And people pay their money because they know that they are guaranteed to pass. So the other provision is to make sure that in there now, even though we have decentralized functions, we must be able to uphold standards in all those private centers, which is one of the provisions that will be coming to you as members of parliament to say we need this provision so that we can close down centers that are not living up to standards. Because if we don't, you can imagine the kind of dangers that some of these people are imposing on our roads and all that if the standards of training is not up to a certain level. The other one is that there has been a process that lasted from 2001 with the Department of Education around quality assurance, and the ministers have gone to Parliament, to Cabinet, to present a final joint policy statement around quality assurance. I talked about higher education and humanus and the vacuum that is existing. Members of Parliament, currently you must have seen a number of colleges and centers that are emerging in the workplace and so on. The reason why these colleges and institutions are emerging is that the technical colleges have been closed down, the technicals have been closed down on, and merged with the universities, and the technical colleges have been merged to form FETs. Now a vacuum is now in existence, and all these colleges are jumping into that space.
But if there is no quality control in terms of all those centers.
And this, again, is more or less like what I've been saying on artisan. Now, in an environment where all these colleges exist and nobody is taking responsibility from government to make sure that what they provide is of acceptable quality, people, as parents, I'm sure you know, you pay a lot of money. Children get certificates which are worthless in the labor market. And yet when young people go to this institution, they are promised wonders when they qualify. And I think that's a national problem. And the establishment of a quality council for trades and occupation is coming in to close that vacuum, to say that for all higher education institutions, the Higher Education Quality Council under the Council for Higher Education exists, and it is taking care of that area. Umalusi is taking care of all the further education institutions. And this council will then begin to control all these other institutions that are operating in the labor market, because there is a crisis out there. And that is why there is a call for government to come in. And we will be coming in with a provision, which is going to be an amendment in the Act, to say that to allow us to be able to intervene, this is the kind of powers that you as members of Parliament must consider giving to the Minister of Labour to be able to establish this body and to make sure that it's able to do that. And lastly, I think there are issues around the term of office of the NSA. It's a minor issue, because currently the Act is 3 years, the CETA lifespan is 5 years, NSDS is 5 years, and we've had problems where the National Security Authority, new members come in, their lifespan is only 3 years, and when they come in, they start questioning everything that has been happening. They want to change everything because some of them are not sure with the process that happened before them, and as such it creates all sorts of problems. So if you align their term of office with the processes, then we believe from 3 years to 5 years, then it will also create stability. So those are some of the technical changes that we have already worked on. Obviously, we still have to go to Cabinet, have some negotiations with NEDLAC, and complete that process and go back to Cabinet and furnish you as members of Parliament the recommendations from NEDLAC and all other public comments and all that. And hopefully, we will be in time so that you are able to conduct those hearings in the next session. Thank you, Honorable Chair, and I'll stop there. Maybe after till then, we can take questions.
Thank you very much. Members, this was a long presentation, and I've given the Dumorosova enough time so that maybe we get more information. That was a presentation for the DDG on employment and skills development service and human resource development. That can we break for tea because now we get what schedule for our procedure that we already sent to. Then we come back immediately. Can you just spend 5 minutes for the tea? There's a lot of information you will agree with me that we don't have enough time here. But I want to have all the deliberations or questions to also come up with a way forward so that we should be able to do that prioritizing issues that need our attention. Because the issues are really different dealing with them now. Can I rather open for questions of clarity and so forth? Jade Maduma, Mrs. Freya, and Mrs. B, Mrs. Twala, Mr. Lake.
Thank you, sir. Chair, the first question is the number of sitters. How many sitters do you have? Looking at this calendar that so far it was 21 sitters, but in my mind I thought that was 42 sitters because I happened to engage with the sitters last Saturday and they said that it was 23. But coming to the very question of certification, Chair. This is a question that we raised yesterday. We welcome the input raised from Mr. Marashova around the intended impact on skills development in the country. There are still some challenges in terms of the role of teachers to realize that objective. One is the question of delay of certification. Last Saturday, I had a meeting in my conference which involved the integration architecture, ranging from preschools to high schools. One of the critical difficulties was challenges was this question of delay of certificates. People stood up in that meeting and said that I've been through this problem for 80 people through this entire problem. Now, 5-6 months down the line, we have never received any certificate. I'm not able to really make use of the piece of paper to market myself out there. And then they see that as a delay to this. In addition to that, Mr. Morozova, is the fact that you were saying earlier on that you are also assessing in terms of physical college, which is the type of housing and technology, to further advance the objective of physical development. In that very same meeting, there was a complaint from the equity college to say that FITA would deploy a service provider from Joburg, for instance, from Gauteng province to come and do training and conduct training in our premises. We just see this person coming here saying that one will conduct. Sometimes we find that even the equity colleges do not have facilities. They don't have workshops sometimes. Even if they don't have workshops, they do not have necessary equipment to conduct that skills development. As a result, we find that it has become more of a theoretical impact than of practical impact. And then we ask the question as to where is this combination of theory and practice in terms of skills development? That remains a challenge. And then there was a counter accusation in that process. So I think that you need also to assess that. Also, in terms of support learners to get workplace experience, I think in page 13, I think there is a challenge of uneven role players in the workplace. We have got the employers. When you talk of employers and you talk of organized or unorganized workers or lenders, let me just put this language into say that workers at workplace who are to consider this pressure of having to get people developed within the establishment. But in terms of the responsibilities, you have got the employer who's having more knowledgeable than the workers. Yet, in terms of the role players at workplace, to develop this workplace skills plan, workers are going to play a role. Now the question is to what extent are you also looking at that angle so that workers are also being capacitated to deal with that challenge, so that the output of that process responds to the needs of even workers themselves, so that workers the employer does not think for workers, but workers participate in shaping their number of their candidates. I'll end there so far, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I've got two questions. I'm just add, I'm new to the committee, and maybe some of the questions will be out of ignorance, but I'm sure Mr. Morozova will then educate me. I want to thank you for the useful and comprehensive briefing. I found it very informative. Mr. Morozova, for you, Madam Chair, on the skills levy allocation, slide number, on page 8, you told us that the mandatory grants are 50% of all the levies collected. And this is for employers, for employers, goes back to employers for training that they do. But you say that some companies do not claim the money that they can, they're entitled to, that they've actually already paid. And I was just wondering why not? What in your experience is the reason for companies not claiming? It doesn't make sense to me. And then I've got a second question on page 12, the slide there. What kind of training? Companies start the training that they want to do, or do they have to adhere to some sort of prescription? kind of claims that they offer the employees? Who decides on the claims, in other words?
Thank you, Jay. From my side, also thank you for the comprehensive presentation. When the different focus areas was identified, there was one focus area that I would think, in our view, is quite an important one that seems to be lacking, not only within the Department of Labor's strategies, but I think in government strategy as a whole. And I would like to ask whether there are considerations being given to the possibility of investigating this very specific focus area. And that is specifically those people with very specific skills who left the country. We all know about what's been written and said about the issue of people leaving the country. And I get the impression often that to a very large extent there seems to be a tendency by government to say, well, at least those people, you don't need to worry about them because at least some other countries can bother about those people. But the problem is those people leaving the country are taking two very important things, or are holding two very important things. On the one hand, the investments, years of investments that this country has put into those people, years of skills and expertise that they would have been able to transfer in South Africa if they stayed here. And then secondly, the international exposure that they get make them actually excellent people to bring back into our economy in order to make our economy more competitive with regard to the rest of the world. So to what extent can we expect the Department of Labor in future to also start looking at this specific focus area as an area for focusing its strategies with regard to bringing back and developing skills in South Africa?
Thank you, Jatin. The next one. I would also like to thank the department for the comprehensive input they have given to us. My questions are short questions. I would like to know, what is the progress in relation to the implementation of human resource development strategy since its inception? And also, I would like to know, are there any overlaps between the GIPSA and APISA? And what is the progress since those have been established? Lastly, Chairperson, I would like to know as well, what is the compliance rate with the Skills Development Act, especially by government partners? Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also thank the department. And once more again, like I said yesterday, how I wish that this workshop could take place when members begin their term, so that they are well equipped to be able to do their work throughout the 5 years. However, we with any available information, we might be able to use beyond where we are now. But Chairperson, just two things. One, to say that I think it will be important for us as a committee, in terms of our way forward, to identify the areas that you want to come back into. One, for instance, how do we prepare ourselves to engage in the conference that is coming? Because I'm not sure whether we are going to be invited there as a committee or there will be a delegation. It's important that we engage some of the issues that we are raising there. Some of the issues I'm sure that we are raising here are the issues that are for that conference, because it's about whether, you know, everything is working as it should. But also to say that as a committee, we need to prepare well in advance for the coming amendment. And we really played with the department matter. We need to stick to the time frame of the introduction of those amendments to the committee. As you are saying, Mr. Moroto, that next year we are not going to have a lot of time because of the election of the government. So, lastly, just on the slide on the funding windows, it would be interesting to just know how we determine those funding windows. They look very good to me, they look very fine, but I'm not sure who determines them, how they are determined. Who then initiates a project? For instance, I saw something like a special project. Is it the department or the community or who initiates those projects? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mayor Rajwari.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Firstly, I want to apologize. It was a really bad start for me in the morning. Car problem, then I had to rush to the program meeting, but I'm glad I'm here. Just that I missed out on a very important presentation. But I am going to ask a question in arising from my experience in the industry, the labor field. Chairperson, on slide 3, page 3, you find that there's a slide at the voluntary benefit to employer. Use workplace as learning environment. I think experience has taught many of us that are holding the MP's position coming from the trade union background that you will find employers handpicking employees from the gate and asking how much of experience has got and employing them because of gaining productivity. But training at workplace comes the last thing for the employer because their concentration is more on production. Now,
I would like to know from the department, am I missing out?
I would ask a question as to how is any workplace in the country monitored that the employers are having a in-house training instead of just throwing people out on the street and taking experienced people. And if there is training going on in the department, where is the market for those people that you are training? Have you got a ready market to market those trained people? As to say that after training, they would go into that field that you have trained them for. I think.
Thank you very much, Mamsi. I think the slide you are talking about is very important, more especially as we are going for this public hearing on workplace discrimination. So as much as we are saying employers should encourage, employers need to be encouraged to use place use workplaces as learning environments, so also to be taught for about the issue of discrimination. So I think that one is important. But also the issue raised by Interchange on the degree, I said to members we need to come up with a way forward because I know that Interchange is going to take a lot of time and because usually you would want to clarify and explain thoroughly. So the amount of time left now is only for him. I don't think we will be able to can talk. But he will also assist us in that Mrotho, but you raised important issues. The issue of NSF, issues that need to be looked at, the issue of manpower training act, those issues that need to be abstracted from that act those are the issues that we need to prioritize and say, when can we again call you and maybe get more clarification on those. But I would want to say, how does the department monitor the work done by the retrenchment response change in relation to the training of these retrenched workers? Also, how do you look into this issue of the implementation of the recognition of prior learning in job grading? Yesterday, members were talking about this job grading. There is a view that there is no progress. There is no progress in the country around job grading. And of course there are quite issues, but as I've said, there are issues of importance that need our attention, that can also lead us to debate them. But I wanted us really from this workshop to have a way forward. Because we are taking the skill development act as an important piece of legislation. Talking about skills development, people are looking at teachers. And indeed, you recognize that the teachers are not the only ones who can deal with skills development. It's a partnership. So this is quite an important piece of legislation, and there's a lot that has to be dealt with. A lot has been said about teachers, and we don't want the focus to be on teachers today, but on legislation for us to understand more what is this all about. I know that this the point three, you elaborated more on page 7, the skills development levy. Yes. I know this one belongs to somewhere else, because like the bad money girl or whatever. But one would like you to have maybe something clarified like that, skills development, skills levy at the top two pieces of legislation on page 5 point to this skills development act, but I think you will be able to can have that in future for us. Just the explanation you made a very good explanation on those pieces of legislation. I know some of them, like I said, the skills development levies act, really we don't need to focus much on it. But I think not now. We don't need to clarify, but in your spare time maybe you can also have that made more easier for us. Even if we know that there are hard copies that explain this, but that can assist us. I'm saying this because we are dealing with so many volume of documents. But if we have a presentation, it's easier for us to look at the presentation and to look at the explanation of the act. But can I just give over that and looking at our time, we say that Koratu, we want to be through by Koratu. Maybe members from your response, members who would want to have the last bite. Okay, half a minute.
My comment is on that perhaps as this committee, even before he responds, we need to put it up front in terms of recommending the department on what it has done in terms of responding to the HIPSA. I think this HIPSA has an intervention from government to really mobilize this case. I think last week I was with the Public Works Protocol Committee visiting Health Train, and we informed there that that project was able, through the assistance of the Department of Labor, to bring back about 23 professionals, the engineers, and out of that about 17 of those engineers are black, who left South Africa, but because of that program, were able to come back and respond to the needs of the scarce kids, which is the country, and therefore we're proud of that. Thank you very much. Thanks very much, Honorable Chairperson. I'll try and be brief. The first question on the number of sitters, yes, Honorable Member, it's 23. The Gazette, there is another Gazette which I did not print because the Gazette were issued at different stages. The one that has, that is why it has those numbers. There's a separate Gazette that has the differences that I can also forward. It will include the other two-seater. The reason maybe that I did not explain on the numbers, you may still have 27. The issue is that we invested a lot of money on the coding system. Now, the coding system is like the people's ID and all that. And when you match two-seaters, what happens on the system is that you either program it in such a way that if it picks companies to be part, let's say you match 22 and 23. Now, there may be companies that have 23 as their key code and the four other numbers that I've indicated, and they continue to maintain that number as their levy, their tax number. So irrespective of the measure that you had, the minute you match two-seaters, the only thing that you can do on the program of the system is to rechannel that any new 24, any old company that used to be on 24, when they pay levy, it immediately goes to 25. So you won't have 24 on the system, but only 25, or you won't have 25, you'll have 24. But then the way it is designed is that you can't change the numbers to start from the beginning so that you have 1 up to 23. So you always have 1 up to 27, but you'll have 1, 2, 3, and then 5, 6, 7, and 9, 10, 11, and 15, whatever, without 40. It's a problem that we have on the technology, and we will have to, I mean, we tried so many things so that we change it, but each time you change it, it throws all the numbers out and companies go in a different direction, which is why we have to retain it as it is. So people will have to bear with us because it's a technical problem that we're sitting with on the collection, and we maintain it as such. The intended impact and I think of the skills development and delays in the issue of the certificate, maybe that, if I can get the information, I will take it up with the CEO of the because I'm sure it's a specific matter that relates to the EDDP sector, so maybe on my way out I'll get that information and follow that one up. The complaint by FET, now, members of parliament must, I think we'll have to bear one thing here. And that is the competition of resources that is emerging out there. You're sitting with universities and colleges running courses at puzzle shops after hours, weekends and all that. And that is because of the arrangements they have with the institutions, that the lecturer runs these private courses and they get
maybe 40% they give, 60% to the college and all that. And it's happening. You look at universities and all that, they are running business schools and skills programs. So there is a tension because teachers have money to say we have technical colleges but not in the mainstream after hours we can participate, and there are these other colleges that are emerging out there, and all of them is marketing. We produce quality, you don't produce quality, and industry say no, you are producing in your mainstream something that we don't want, we would rather go to that college. And I talked about the quality concern for trade and occupation. It is precisely to deal with that problem, and hence the need for an amendment, because there are tensions around who is providing quality, whether the workplace is sufficient or is not, and it's part of that problem. The question around the unequal role by employers and workers on the training committees and what capacity are we developing. I think we acknowledge that problem, and I'm sure Lev and Khalid yesterday talked about the strengthening of social, strengthening of civil society fund, and the money that we make available. I mean, on the funding windows of the NSF, you will notice that one of the funding windows is strictly meant for capacity building of stakeholders. And that funding window is funding window number 7. It is precisely aimed at making sure that the constituencies participating in the skills development interventions, labor, business and so on, have the necessary people with the capacity. CITAS have also offered to pay a full-time person employed in a trade union strictly for skills development to be dedicated to, I mean, to work full-time and get instructions from the union but paid by the CITA to coordinate those interventions and so on. And I think that is part of the problem. I think that the problem that we have experienced is what we have tabled last time, to say that most of the people start this process there, but the sooner they understand, they leave the trade union to join the CITA, which is the reason why today you have a lot of people working in CITA who are ex-people working in the government department or working in the trade union or working from, I mean, in the employer. So the sooner they understand, they leave their constituency to take a full-time position in the CITA. And that has been a constant problem. Capacity is being provided. There was a question on the mandatory grant, the 50%, and what are the reasons for companies not claiming. I mean, previously the claim rate was low, and that was because we had a large number of companies that were earning below, that had a payroll that was below 500,250. I mean, their contribution was very small, and they just treated as tax and all that. But when the from the time the exemption was granted, that is from all those small companies, the claim rate increased to about 97%. As we speak now, the claim rate is at 97%, because big companies have got systems and all that, and that is why there is very little money left for discretionary funds. So the question of unclaimed levies is a way, a reason for, I mean, it's something that is got. The only issue that I raise is that companies provide a plan, but then they take time to come and claim, and that unfortunately leaves a sitter in a situation where they harbor this cash. That does not suggest that they don't claim. They flood the sitter just before the deadline that was actually posted, and that is why you find that most of the claims get processed during that period. Who decides on training within companies? Normally, this is a function of the line managers and working with their HR people, but the Act makes provision for companies to establish workplace committees
because these are the workplace committees that should consist of employers and trade unions to decide on the kind of skills that are needed, who goes on to training and all that. But the tendency in most cases has been for HR managers to run these processes alone. Unfortunately, most of the HR managers are people who are involved in industrial collective bargaining. They are not necessarily the best people to work with companies. And as such, the trust relations are not up to scratch. And they tend to do these things on their own without involving the trade unions. Hence, we have this problem around it. And I think our campaign has been to try and make sure that we have workplace forums that are rigid with people capacitated and we can improve on the quality of WFPs. Questions, Mr. Spies, Honorable Spies, around the focus area that is lacking in government around the people who have left the country. I think this is it's not a Department of Labor problem alone, but it's a national problem. And I think the committees that I serve in, for instance, GIPSA, I think you may know about the diaspora, the South African diaspora. It is basically a campaign that is aimed at saying South Africans come back and there are opportunities at home. And I think the example that was given is part of that. I've been on a number of those trips with the Deputy President of Australia, New Zealand, and other countries where she has gone, where I was not involved. But I know that part of the program is part of the diaspora. In those visits, there are meetings that are convened by the South African missions abroad with all the South African expatriates, where presentations are done on the opportunities that are available at home, listening to their problems and updating them on the changes that have been taking place and how some of their concerns are being addressed back at home, the political changes and so on. And some of the people are taking those opportunities because life in those countries, what we've discovered is that it's not as rosy as people want us to believe. If you are a foreigner, they treat you as a foreigner in those countries, irrespective. And I think some of them are taking those opportunities. It is slow and so on. We are part of the Home Affairs. In terms of the Immigration Act, the Department of Labor is also party to issue of the work permit and as part of the quota list and all that, and the scarce and critical skills. That is also part of getting not only people who left the country, but people from other countries that have the skills that we don't have, who can be issued permits for 3 years, up to 5 years, on condition that they train local people. So the Immigration Act and the quota permit is part of addressing that problem. The issue around progress in relation with the implementation of the HRD, I think there are a number of components here. The progress in relation to the implementation of the NSDS is done in a number of ways. CITAS published, CITAS Umsobumbu Youth Fund, the NPI, published the annual report which come to this committee. And the hearings that we are conducting are about the progress that they've achieved in relation to that. And in the PEC, I've also included one of the publications, this one that we normally launch at the annual skills conference. This gives you progress on the implementation of the National Skills Development Strategy. Basically, what we do is that we consolidate everything that CITAS do, Umsobomvu, all the projects that we fund under the NSF, and then say these are the targets that we have. This is what we've achieved. But your question was progress on HRD. Now, HRD at the higher level is that education is supposed to be coordinating a program where they take reports such as this and do an overall coordination, the passing rate in the schools,
in universities, the research at science and technology and so on, and then say as the country on HRD, this is what is happening. Now, unfortunately, that is not happening to the satisfaction of everybody, which is why there are problems around us as a country being able to say this is how much we are progressing on HRD. The reports are confined to the little piece that we're doing. But I think with the reports such as this, that should be simpler because it's just a combination of all different reports to formulate one report. Whether there's overlap between us, GISA, GISA, NSA, and what we're doing, I think there's no overlap. I think HRD was supposed to take lead, and I did indicate that GISA came in because that leadership was not there. What the GIPSA is doing is to look at the priority skills. For instance, the National Skills and Critical Skills List that GIPSA is using is a product of the Department of Labor because they are doing the coordination. And our minister is part of the joint task team. I serve on the GIPSA Technical Working Group because we are the chief of the department. The other representatives come from other departments. So it is basically a coordination. And we're part of the driving process. The compliance level by government departments. Now, this has been one of the biggest problems, I must acknowledge. The issue here is that the department, and I think the public service sector and the Department of Public Service and Administration, the SAMDI, the South African Institute of Management Development, and the Public Service Commission. We have raised this issue with all those bodies because they are the key players in the public service to say that, you know, we need some assistance in the coordination of this area. And I think there is a commitment from that part because the Minister of Public Service and Administration, I mean, the question of budget, Treasury has now separated that, and if you go to the budget for the medium-term expenditure framework, that thick book, the first document, the first 3 pages, you will see now training expenditure by government departments, starting from the presidency, parliament. We know, for instance, how much is the payroll of parliament, and what is the proportion of the money that parliament setting aside for training and how much is that being used. Everybody is now forced to disclose that amount. And I think it is a question now of saying, taking everyone and the DGs, the whoever is responsible, and forming that as part of the performance agreement so that that aspect can be complied to and that they can full disclosure around it. And I think it is part of that concern. But there is that commitment to deal with that. Issues around the identification of areas that the committee should assist us, Honorable Sonny. I think this links to the issues that Honorable Chairperson raised. And I think if you take the, I would direct you to the last 2 slides, because I believe that if there's one area where the committee can really assist us, it is that because of the legislation. The second one, I think, has to do with the conference. You are invited, and I'm sure that invite is coming in. And I think your participation will be quite critical there. And I'm sure, in terms of the papers that have been generated, you will also receive them so that you can begin to prepare yourself. Because I think the most important thing is to understand the issues so that when you put them into legislation, you understand the context and the difficulties. And I think that would be the second area around the conference. And I think those slides attempt to touch on that. The question around how are the funding windows determined, I think there is a slide that says, we take the strategy. In fact, the funding windows, all of them, if you look at the strategy, they are very much in line with the strategy. They don't deviate. Those numbers clearly indicate the linkages. so they are founded here, because the minute you adopt this, the funding windows become automatic. And the issue is around the percentage allocation. What we normally do is to say, if the NSA is to receive 1.1 billion, what is the percentage you allocate to funding window number one, number two, number three, and all that? Now, the rest of the funding windows share a small amount. The biggest allocation goes to funding window number, especially the social development, because this is the one that takes half the national peace fund. This is the training of unemployed that is happening throughout the provinces where the provincial governments and all that sit through the selection committees and all that. And that is where the bulk of the money comes in. The rest are small percentages. But the NSA does the recommendation, and then we can look into the budget allocation, and the money is then allocated on those bases. Because if you don't do it upfront, you then have the auditor general's queries. Before you spend, you must have allocated money upfront and so on. And anybody can initiate a project as long as it is in line with the criteria. Now, what we just gave is a brief of the funding windows. Each one of them has special criteria, and there are small booklets, there are small pamphlets that we can make available. We put some of them on the website so that people can know what is expected before they even apply. Question from Mam Chize on the benefits to employers and using the workplace as a learning environment. And how do we actually monitor that? Now, Mam Chize, this is a very difficult issue to do. We are trying it, but we are not doing it to our satisfaction. In the sense that our inspectors will never be able to monitor the thousands of workplaces that are available. At the core, I think if the trade unions were to assume their responsibility in the
world, we will be able to
If the trade unions were to assume their responsibility, I think we will be able to claim and take responsibility in terms of this area, because the people who can help you in monitoring on the ground is your trade unions and the HR managers who are filling those workplace skills plans, because then their accountability will improve. And I think it is part of the shared and spirit in which we said we're doing this. We can't agree at NEDLAC in the Growth and Development Summit at GIPSA that the country is short of skills when we go to the application and we move in different directions. Obviously, there are fraudsters in the system. I mean, you try, you put all the stops and the friends, but you always find one or two employers who will not live up to the spirit of the act. And I must acknowledge that it is one problem. You also the question of where people are placed after the training. I think this is a question, an issue maybe that I covered before. That the question of gaps and critical skills is precisely aimed at ensuring that before we train, let us look at where companies are going. What is the new technology that is emerging? What are the challenges that are coming in from the competitors and all that? So that we don't train left-handed artisans when we need right-handed artisans and training in the opposite direction. So I think if the schooling system and everybody else was to assist and adapt quickly, we will move with the kind of speed. The problem is that our institutions take 5 to 6 years before they change curriculum. And if you are to take a cell phone, I'm sure all of you know that the contract you have normally is 24 months, but even the 20 months is the maximum. That is because of the rapid way in which technology is changing, the computers and the thing. Now, if you have to take 5 years to change curriculum, by the time you change in another 5 years to come to the step one, technology has changed maybe 20 or 15 times and you are behind. And I think it is a challenge around how do we begin to change this thing so that we are very fast without having to research and research and research before you change curriculum. Because that is unfortunately what our systems are doing. They produce documents and they make a decision, and by the time they make that decision, the train has already left the station. The issue around the monitoring of the social planning, implementation, retrenchment and all that, one difficulty, but if you look at the report of the National Productivity Institute, apart from productivity, half of their other funding, which is being made under the National Skills Fund, is for them to assist us in intervening in all those companies that are facing distress, so that firstly, they don't only intervene. There are 3 to 4 stages. The first stage is to go in and improve productivity. The second stage is to go in and say to a company, how can we help you to improve on productivity and cut your losses? The third one is to say, because we realize that retrenchment is unavoidable, what are the other kind of things that you can leave out, and what are the other relief measures you can introduce, such as short time and all the working short time 3 days. And the last stage is to say the retrenchment has come in and we can't avoid it, and let us retrain people who will be going back to you know, the Eastern Cape from a mine in Carltonville or whatever, so that when they eventually go back, at least they've got other skills that they can use their retrenchment package in. And we have now brought in the unemployment insurance fund because its liquidity is increasing. And we believe that with the unemployment insurance fund playing an active role in that area, we will be able to increase the training of the people who are in the unemployment insurance fund queue, so that they don't just take the package that they receive and blow it out by buying a taxi because somebody bought a taxi. They must understand the business plan, the conditions there, and that eventually when they get their package, they go and they earn at least money from the UI. They are able to start their own business and all that. There was a question on the job grading and recognition of talent. Now, I think this is a difficult issue. When you train people, obviously you raise their expectations and they want their status in industry to improve. But an employer trains people because they want them to work better, to produce good quality products, and to also reduce the cost because they want to cut down on the scrap. So you have got two very different interests that clash, and unfortunately the only thing that can translate into income in a person is if they move up the job grading and they get an income. And for the company, on the other hand, even on RPL, which is becoming a problem, is that for years, I mean, you know that during military conscription and all that, thousands of Black South Africans, colored Indians and all that, who were not subjected to military conscription, were the ones who are running industry. They have their skills. But some of these companies have now realized that if you get these people to qualify, you increase their mobility because they are now marketable, they've got a certificate. And if you don't pay them a higher wage, then they leave your company. So the best thing is to keep them there. Don't make them to qualify, because then you can keep them in your industry. The only thing that you can do is to pay them a slightly higher wage than everybody else, but don't pay them the artisan equivalent. So
you have got a chicken and egg situation, because on one hand, people know they can do the job, they can fix the car and all that, but they are called all sorts of funny things, operator, you know, all sorts of things, you know, handyman and all that. Now, the act is quite clear. It makes provision that if you have got years of experience, I mean thousands of people who went into the army, who qualified as artisans, did not serve apprenticeship system in full. They only had to go to the army and they had to provide proof of work experience and they were allowed to do trade tests. Now, all these people have worked, some have got 10, 15 years, and because of those tensions, that is why there are problems, you know, around fast-tracking the so the system allows for that, but those politics are impacting on that, and I think this is one of the things that would come in there. Because on the skill shortage, if we were to fast-track the assessment of those people who have got all these years of experience, I mean, I'm sure you all have houses here, and I'm sure you know who has built your wall, who has actually changed this window there and all that, who is building your house somewhere, main extension. It's not all the people with the paper qualification. It is all these people. You drive around, you see them carrying brushes, throw forth and all that. Those people can do the job, but the danger is that once they qualify, they become expensive. So keep them there. And it's politics again, because we believe that the skill shortage problem, if we're dealing in this country and get those people also qualified, we can break its neck or its back. But I'm sure you understand the problem that we're sitting in. The relationship and impact of the legislation, and maybe assisting members to understand some of the aspects, chapters, and I think maybe we can still do another workshop where we go to those Manpower Training Act and the SAPA Act and all that. But the most important thing that I was highlighting is that it is important for members. And I think you don't necessarily, I know reading the whole act, you work with this thing, it's boring. But just to get the memorandum on the objects of those acts is quite important, because you are able to clearly go to the understanding of the intention of this act without reading all those references to factors or whatever. But I think it is the combination of all this legislation that governs what we do, because you don't only work under one legislation, and unfortunately this legislation don't only, there are those that are within the ambit of the Labour Portfolio Committee, and there are those that are, I mean, the Levies Act, it does impact on Skills Development Act, but it is sitting in a completely different committee, and it governs how you use that money, and you are looking at the other one. So it's a question of also interacting. And I think in the same way that you go to COP, you are able to now link and understand the difficulties and the tensions, because as different your committees, you understand this is differently and you administer different laws. And where we sit, we have to, unfortunately, do what we have to do within the combination of all those laws. And it is not one of the easiest things to do. And maybe with the workshop that you're proposing, you can have a setup. I don't know if I've left any questions, but I thought I'd try. But maybe, like the last thing that you said, Shepard, and I know I skipped the NSF. That is the other thing that I highlighted in those last two slides, that the conference and those two slides around the legislation is where we believe that you yourself as a member of the committee can have. And the NSF issue around the listing, you will recall that when we were in SCOPA, SCOPA threw this thing back to you to say the Labour Portfolio Committee
must deal with this issue and come back with a solution.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and that I have really given you more time, extra 15 minutes, because I know that whenever you respond, you would want to respond thoroughly. But I think that was helpful for us. And of course, members, I think we will have, when we meet, we will talk about the workshop, the two-day workshop, and then come up with a clear way forward. Now, because it's one of your already. But thank you very much, Dr. Otoba. This was very much helpful for us, and then up-to-date information is going to assist us in future engagement, including the current event. And to say, I know the members, it's late, and we want to go, but let me thank Tatemo Rotoba and your team, Tatemo Gwena and your team at the back. Thank you very much for coming, for really accompanying Tatemo Rotoba also, and Tatemo Mashomola. I think this was an exposure to yourself for being with us for 2 days, being a new member in the department. I think this was also helpful. You now know what is expected from you in future when coming to present to us. You know, members, but today it was a workshop. I hope next time they will also again teach you what you, because when we need something from you, that will be a different one, of today. But thank you very much for coming, and you are invited for lunch. I'm sure it should be ready, the finger lunch. And members, tomorrow is Women's Day. We all want to go back to our constituencies to remind members to say, let's have and enjoy our day as women. I'm sure our counterparts will really support us in our celebrations tomorrow. And of course, to remind members about next week, there is nothing. There is training of members. Some members will have the whole of next week, so we don't have any meeting. So, to shine next week. No meeting next week. And of course, the issue of skill development, I received this invitation, though it was sent long, sometime I'm sure last by September, October. We are invited for on this National Skills Development Conference, but only five of us. So we will talk when we meet on the 21st. We are meeting on the 21st to continue with those hearings with some speakers. I think it's four speakers. Could we please go and prepare for that date on the 21st? On that date, we will also talk about the delegation, which will be going to that conference in Johannesburg. And of course, thank you very much, all of you. Please join us to our different venues tomorrow on our celebration. And I think I'm not leaving anything. Just to thank the PMG people also on that day. I'm sure our issues are well captured. Thank you very much. And then adjourn.
Happy Women's Day for all of them. Just put it down.